Hey, everybody, and welcome back to another episode of the Ruby Rogues podcast. This week on our panel, we have Valentino Stoll.
Hey there.
John Epperson.
Hello, everybody.
Dave Kimura.
Hello.
I'm Charles Max Wood from Top End Devs. And this week, we're going to cut through all the red tape.
Dave, or you introduce it. One or the other.
Right. This was kind of your idea, Dave. So do you want to kind of set the stage for us here?
So I think that a lot of people, there's almost a culture shock as a solo developer moving to a team where you have to then, especially for a young team, have to create processes around how you do things. So once we have a feature that has been completed and we want to get it to production, we understand that there is a step of deploying it to production, but it's not as simple as just deploying the master branch to production. Usually there are a lot of steps and processes in place or needs to be created around that. And I really just want to explore some of those processes, and maybe the viewers can see if in their environment and what they are doing, do they have maybe some things that they are doing that's unnecessary, where it's just one of those pieces of red tape because it's always been there. Or maybe someone higher up has introduced a certain process that is not really needed. It's not providing any actual benefit or security for the team.
Hey folks, this is Charles Max Wood from Top End Devs. And lately I've been working on actually building out Top End Devs. If you're interested, you can go to topenddevs.com/podcast and you can actually hear a little bit more about my story, about why I'm doing what I'm doing with Top End Devs, why I changed it from devchat.tv to Top End Devs. But what I really want to get into is that I have decided that I'm going to build the platform that I always wished I had with devchat.tv, and I renamed it to Top End Devs because I want to give you the resources that are going to help you to build the career that you want, right? So whether you want to be an influencer in tech, whether you want to go and just max out your salary and then go live a lifestyle with your family, your friends, or just traveling the world or whatever, I want to give you the resources that are going to help you do that. We're going to have career and leadership resources in there, and we're going to be giving you content on a regular basis to help you level up and max out your career. So go check it out at topenddevs.com. If you sign up before my birthday, that's December 14th. If you sign up before my birthday, you can get 50% off the lifetime of your subscription. Once again, that's topenddevs.com.
Well, hang on, because why not just use Heroku, right? And then it really does just push your main or master branch to production, right?
Is Heroku a sponsor of this episode?
Nope.
Okay, well then, because Heroku will go down on you unexpectedly.
Or DigitalOcean app platform is the other. That's what I've been using to deploy. But yeah, I've kind of been soloing it just to give a little bit of context on a lot of my stuff. I commit, I break the code, the website doesn't come up, I go fix the code and it comes back up. Thank heaven for Sentry. But anyway.
Yeah. Well, you know, I really don't want to get into the infrastructure side of things on this topic, because I think that there's so much, like before we even get to that point, but I was looking at DigitalOcean app platform and I was really disappointed with it recently, simply because they take some very harsh assumptions in mind.
Yeah, they do.
If they are basically assuming that you are using Webpacker, because if you try to deploy a Rails 7 application using JS bundling and CSS bundling, it won't work. You still need the Node package on there, but they don't have it included. So it is something I believe that they are aware of, namely because I actually talked to them and they're aware of it. But it's something that they are actively looking at, investigating, incorporating some kind of feature flag there.
Yeah, I've run afoul of some of those assumptions.
To be honest, I think that's something that plagues like almost all of these out-of-the-box type solutions, right? Whether it's like Elastic Beanstalk or even Heroku over the years, right, has had various moments in which their stuff has made assumptions. And we've all, those who have interacted with Heroku have therefore needed to like deal with a problem. So, I mean, all of them have problems when their goal is, okay, you don't know anything about what's going on, so I'm going to package up the solution for you and deliver it, right? That's just kind of a thing that I think comes with that style of product, so to speak. Not to excuse them. I'm just saying it's common.
Yeah, and there is no silver bullet. Yeah, I've looked at all of the different solutions that claim, this is a Ruby on Rails deployment mechanism that has been created, whether it is App Platform, Heroku, Beanstalk, AWS App Runner, or any of the various tools that you can attach on top of your infrastructure to do your deployments for you. In most cases, I've seen that there are a lot of best practices that's not being taken at the infrastructure level.
Yeah.
So
you did say that you weren't necessarily wanting to get into the infrastructure. And I think there's a conversation to be had about some of the other processes. For example, when I worked at Morgan Stanley, it's weird to talk about that openly now because I've always kind of played it close to my vest to who I'm working for these days, but since I'm not there anymore. Anyway, their process essentially was we would... So the master branch always deployed. So if you pushed the master, it would deploy after it ran through CI. So if it passed CI, it would deploy. But there was a process before that, right? So you would submit a pull request and then it would get reviewed. And then it seemed like most of the time it would get a rubber stamp, right? You had to have two reviewers. And then once it was approved by two people, you could merge it. And once it actually got merged, then it would get pushed up. And yeah, I know other people have other processes for this. And I'm a little curious that level, what that looks like. And I'm also curious, Dave, if this is kind of the level you were intending to talk about.
Yeah, even in your example, so let's just start at the code review part. So someone makes a PR, and then that PR gets code reviewed by two people. What is expected of that code review? So do the people doing the code review actually pull down your feature branch, and do they execute it on their local environment or whatever dev environment that they have to verify that things are working as they would assume? Or
of course not.
Yeah.
Well, we should talk about that specifically because I actually am and in the camp that I don't think that's important, right? Because that's, for me, that's a piece of work that's QA. So if you give your developers the QA responsibility, then absolutely, right?
Ooh,
but if you have, for example, a separate, if you have a separate QA team, does it belong to the developer to do that, right?
So
we should talk about that. We should revisit, but yeah, keep going so we can get the list of points, Dave.
So if, I agree with you, John. I don't think the developer doing the code review should pull down the project at that feature branch and then execute it on their local environment. That causes a lot of hiccups for the developer doing the code review, especially if they were in the middle of something, because I have had situations where I've git stashed everything in my project, pulled down to help someone else, and then when I go to reapply my stash, something happened. Something crazy happened, and it did not apply correctly. It got merge conflicts for whatever reason, or it just said the git stash apply failed. And then I had to go through and spend a few hours kind of figuring out what the heck happened. So, if you are doing that, where you are actually pulling down the code, is that a necessary step in your process? It adds a lot of overhead. Unless if you have a completely separate directory or Docker Compose environment that you were then loading that into, it can cause a lot of headaches. So at that point, what actually is supposed to happen in a code review? If someone isn't using the proper spacing or the proper styling, should that be called out at the code review time? Or should we be focusing on the actual business logic that was introduced?
Yeah, it's funny because, I kind of tongue-in-cheek jumped in with, of course not, but we really rarely pulled down the code, right? Now, this did bite us a couple of times, right? Because you look at the code, it looks fine, it passes CI, and then it gets deployed, and then something broke. And when it broke, then it trickles back through to the dev team, and they're like, why didn't you catch this in the code review? And turn around and talk to the developer that wrote the code. Well, did you run this on your machine? And the silence is deafening, right? It's, no, I just wrote the code and committed it. And so I think there's even a kind of a level in there somewhere beyond this where it's like, if you're writing the code, you should be running it on your machine. I think that goes without saying, or at least I thought it went without saying before I worked with some of these guys that pulled this a couple of times. But yeah, not out of overhead, but just out of a sense of you're usually not code reviewing it to validate that it functions, because you would assume that it at least works on the developer's machine, the guy that wrote it or the gal that wrote it. So then it's just a matter of, hey, does this conform with what I would expect this to look like? Does it have any glaring issues? Did they make any major architectural issue mistakes, or I don't know, things like that?
Yeah, I think it comes down to like your culture, right, of your team, and like what you're valuing, like what's the purpose of code review to your team? Like what value you're getting out of it, right? If you're like, well, it's just an extra stage of testing, all right, I guess then that makes sense, right? Or if, for example, it kind of sounds like you maybe had a scenario where there's sort of this expectation on your team that people are delivering features that don't work. And so therefore you're like, well, we need to have like this extra round before it goes to QA because we don't want to engage the QA process until this point or something. And so maybe in that case, like I wasn't there, like I don't want to like say yay or nay, right? Like that wasn't, but yeah, for me, I think that I've definitely been at places where people just pulled down during code review because they thought that that was just what code review was. And like there was no impetus for it. There was no motivation for it. Like from like the team had never discussed that they were getting value out of that. That's just what people did. And after talking about things, like that was a lot of time that was being spent doing something. And into that place, you know, we actually had a QA team and their job was actually to catch bugs and things like that. So they were just doubling up on the work. And, you know, you could be like, well, sometimes they catch things. And I mean, I guess my point would be like, you're spending somebody's time when you're having people do code review. So why are you spending that time, right? Typically, in my mind, the things that you're getting out of code review are, like you said, right? Why do you even care about architecture, for example? Well, you're hoping that a year down the road, you don't say, hey, you know, actually, we rewrote this in like a really bad way. And now we have all these problems all over the app because we just let this code get in. I feel at the end of the day, that's what I feel like is usually the most cited thing for why we do code review, is to prevent us from like coding ourselves into a corner or allowing juniors to completely refactor the app without anyone else noticing, kind of thing. So I feel like those are usually the most cited things, not, hey, we just needed an extra test cycle and we wanted to put some of our most expensive employees onto the testing cycle.
I'm curious, Dave and John, you know, you can kind of chime in too here since you've both weighed in on this, but what is the purpose of the code review then, right? Because if it's to download the code and run it, or download the code and run the test, I mean, that's what CI does more or less.
So I think, and I probably don't follow the best practices here myself, but I usually look for any kind of like real big red flag optimizations that could be done to say, hey, I noticed that this is being introduced. It's going to do this kind of loop or recursion. Have you thought about approaching it this other way? And that usually will have a performance impact in the long run. But those kind of things, I think, really should have happened a bit earlier in the chain, instead of at the point where a developer is now saying like, hey, we are done with this and, you know, I'm ready to ship it. And because that's essentially saying like, hey, let's go back to the drawing board. And now we're kind of at a waterfall design pattern instead of, you know, being more agile. But I do try to look for anything that could be introduced, like an edge case that could generate a support call, essentially.
I just wanted to chime in here. This whole conversation reminds me a lot of a post Kent Beck made last year on change and basically the cost of software. And he made this like kind of cool equation where he breaks down the cost of change is the cost of understanding the code plus the cost of modifying it plus the cost of validating it and then the cost to deploy it. And that really resonates with me. I try to think about it all the time. And kind of like the code review is part of that cost, right? Like it's the cost to validate as an extra step to make sure that it works right. But it's also like it adds into all these costs, right? To me, code reviews, you want to make sure that it stays easy to understand and easy to modify. And like to Dave's point, like if something would work better kind of in the longer run, or maybe you can point out things that could lead to refactorings later down the road, those all kind of point to these extra costs to digest it and change it over time, which I think can be caught in a review versus like just getting the code to pass tests.
It's kind of funny to switch topics a bit, but staying on this idea of red tape, I won't mention the company because I did not work there, but I do work with a colleague who did. And one of the things that was said is that they were not allowed to install gems on their local development machine. They were not allowed to install gems.
Oh, wow.
Actively blocked. And if they wanted to install a gem, they had to open up a ticket with IT. IT had to then basically whitelist this. And then they, if approved, then it would be allowed and it could get added in and they could run bundle and stuff. And when I heard that, I was thinking like, I would never work for that company. That's completely ridiculous. And that's insane. I'm not going to do that. You know, if I want to use a gem, I have a reason why I want to use a gem. I'm going to use it. But now, many years later, I'm thinking, that's actually not that bad of an idea. It sucks. It's adding red tape to the process. But if we go to the root of why are they implementing this red flag or this, you know, red tape, what is the actual purpose of it? If it's for security, that they actually want to do a manual code review of that gem to make sure that things aren't getting introduced, any kind of major security risks, especially if the company has had a history of being exploited in the past. But then also, it kind of makes you think or have to think, do I really need, and this is really the point that I'm getting to, do I really need to add this gem into my application? Or am I just left padding it?
I feel like some gem hurt you.
Left padding it.
That somebody else added.
Well, left pad was the NPM package that was removed from NPM, and everything or a whole bunch of other packages depended on it. And yeah, it caused a whole bunch of consternation when people did NPM and install, because then NPM said, I can't find this. We had a conversation, interestingly enough, on some related stuff with supply chain attacks, right? It was on JavaScript Jabber, so we were talking about NPM specifically, but it was the same idea, right? Where a malicious code gets inserted into a package or gem. In that case, it was an NPM package, right? And then something else winds up depending on it, or something depends on it, and then it has the code inserted into it later. And then when you upgrade it, you know, you get the malicious code. And so, yeah, limiting what people can install into the app or onto their machine does mitigate some of this. And the other thing is that I see a lot of people that will put gems in to get one little piece of something that it does. And then what you wind up with is you wind up with this kind of dependency bloat, where at the end of the day, you have three gems that could all solve the problem, but because you kind of pick them for different other things that they solve, at the end of the day, you may be able to eliminate one. And people usually don't go audit their gems and say, all right, we're going to pull this one out, and we're going to pull this one out, and we're going to replace that one. So
one gem example that, I mean, this is a pretty minute thing, but Friendly ID. Friendly ID is a really cool gem that does a lot for you as far as making your URLs pretty. Instead of having something like a post/1, you could have a post/whatever this post is about. And that's a really nice feature. But if you never change your slug, or if you want your slug to change whenever you update the record, if you don't need to keep a history of it, then are you complicating your application or your tech debt by introducing a gem when it's not really necessary? Because you can create your own implementation of Friendly ID fairly easily without needing to add in a whole nother gem.
Yep.
So I think all of these things are true, but at the same time, so I definitely wanted to move back to the other thing, but to address gems specifically, like, I mean, I'm very much in the middle of the road, right? I think you should have to justify adding gems, right? Because I think that once again, I actually love, Valentina, that you brought up Kimpec stuff, right? Adding a gem to your project, anytime that you add dependencies to your project, that's a cost, right? Costs aren't evil, they're just costs. So is your cost giving you the value that you want, right? So the reason why, for I think a great example of this, like for example, a good gem is Devise. Now, I know there's alternatives out there, but my point is like, not, and maybe not necessarily Devise, right? Just picking an auth gem, right? And the reason why people ask, people have asked me in the past, well, you know, like, what about rolling your own? Like, then I can make it more lean and stuff like this. But I mean, do any of you guys like wake up in the morning and dream about security issues? I mean, maybe you do. I don't know if you do, Valentino, or anything. But like, I worked at a company where they did. They rolled their own auth gem, and they rolled their own HMAC implementation because they were doing that. Except the HMAC implementation was not a complete implementation, and it had like they had the security hole that like. Basically, they didn't hash the whole thing. And so they hash certain kinds of stuff. And so like, because you didn't hash the whole thing, like it literally does nothing. So, you know, I was like, hey, we've got this really complicated and buggy HMAC implementation. And all I have to do is like add some extra stuff and boom, like I can get in, right? Like I was like, this isn't cool. But what I'm trying to get at here, right, is like when you... I think that security is a great example of this. Most people do not have the large amount of knowledge that you have to have in order to build one of these gems, right, effectively. So it's a great thing that we have this community gem that's taken care of by the community. And those of us that are in the community, sorry, I say us, but I mean people that are not me because this isn't me, do get up in the morning. And the first thing they think about after their coffee is, huh, that's a security problem. I should fix that, right? Those people are contributing to these gems and they're making all of our lives better, right? And there are lots of gems out there that are like that, where somebody that is an expertise in that domain is contributing to the wider community and we're all reaping the benefits from it. And so I guess what I'm trying to get at here is like, I think for every single dependency that you have, you just have to make a choice. Is this thing giving me more value than it's costing me or not? And I absolutely agree with you, Dave, and Chuck. So far, your opinions have sort of fallen on the side of like, it's dangerous to add gems. But like, yeah, I think lots of people add gems way too freely and they just don't consider the cost ever. But I also do feel like sometimes people talk about the horrors of gems and I'm like, gems aren't horrors. They're just So I'm not saying that you guys are that far over, but I definitely like want to express that like I think the extremes on both ends are like they can both be like a little bit too nuts for me.
Yeah, for my take, I mean, some things are just way more work than they're worth to write myself, right? Either because of expertise, as you pointed out with Devise, or just because it would take me days and days to build it, or it would take me an hour to install the gem, run the generators in my Rails app, and have everything set up and working. But the flip side is those more complicated gems tend to, and this is the part of it that's hard to really get your head around, they tend to have more dependencies themselves. They tend to be more complicated. And so in those cases, they may actually introduce security or other issues, right? Or they may not play nicely with some other aspect of things. Or they may break when you upgrade Rails the next time. And so you have to consider all those things. And I think a lot of times, yeah, people just pull the gem in and just hook it up and assume that it's going to all be okay. And you can't know that. I don't know that there's a good process to audit them as you go.
I think code review.
I think there's a good kind of rule of thumb when it comes to dependencies in Ruby. And I think it there are some parallels to JavaScript even. Right. And this goes back to the debate of HTTP, right? Like, what do you use for your network requests in Ruby? And a lot of people don't like the interface that Ruby provides, the net HTTP interface. Mm-hmm. And then you end up with like three or four different libraries that all wrap the net HTTP layer different way, but people prefer some over the others. So, I mean, I don't know about you guys, but I've worked on projects where there have been four or five different network libraries that all do the same thing. And I feel like anything like that is kind of like a good sign for review, right? Like, do we need another wrapper around the existing core libraries to do the same thing? Where it could, like John was saying, it could potentially introduce an extra layer of security issues because some teams get to fix security issues, you know, sooner than others. So you could end up pulling in, say you use the HTTP gem and they fix a security issue. It could be in one of these other libraries. What's to say that they haven't also fixed it? And I think that's kind of a good rule of thumb is maybe just focusing on one gem that does a thing can help greatly reduce the number of dependencies you have.
This is why I think that code review is the right place to help solve this problem, because code review in my mind, so now we're kind of going back a little bit, like what code review is. In my mind, code review is one of the places where your team is sort of creating consensus around things. The goal of code review, right, is to get another set of eyeballs. Well, one of the goals of code review is to get another set of eyeballs on stuff, right? And if you're, I worked on a project where we had five different CSV. So before, this was like early Ruby, I guess, before faster CSV actually became standard library CSV. And so we had five different CSV parsing / generating libraries included, including one that was like CSV Pirate or Pirate CSV. I don't remember exactly. But I mean, I'll be honest, when it was like walk the plank, and like there were so many like pirate things, but I had no idea what anything was because it didn't make any sense to me. It was just all pirate language, which is funny, and it was kind of cool in that way, but I would just read stuff and I'd be like, I don't know what's up. So I definitely convinced everybody on the team to yank that. But yeah, I mean, in the end of the day, like, you've got these five gems in there. Yeah. Okay. So I feel like the HTTP party, REST client, what's the one that starts with an F or whatever?
Faraday?
Whatever. Faraday. Yep. Faraday is like a dependency of so many things, right? So your Rails app probably has Faraday in it because somebody else dragged Faraday in as a dependency, honestly. And you're like sitting there. I don't like to use Faraday. Like ever, but I'm not gonna, like, I'll typically be a fan of like us saying, okay, as a team, we're gonna use HTTP party, right? Or we're gonna use REST client or whatever it is that we picked, right? And if something gets dragged in as a dependency, well, that just kind of sucks, but we'll just like let that go. But I've also been on teams where we said, oh no, we got Faraday, and so now we're just gonna use Faraday for everything. And then you pull in something that has HTTP party as a dependency and you're like, oh, we can't use that gem because we can't add that. At the end of the day, I think it's just important that you and the people that you're working with, like, decide what's right for you. You know, what do you want to work with? Do you have somebody on your team that cares about security? And so you feel more comfortable dealing with multiple ones of these HTTP wrappers, right? Do you feel comfortable rolling your own auth, you know, for some particular reason because you have that domain expertise? Like, I certainly don't want to be here saying no one should ever do that, right? I just think that you have to be cognizant of what's the right choice for you. I'm a big believer that the average developer is smarter than the average bear. And I think that in general, we can trust most developers to make reasonably, I'm a very big trust first person, and then you only deal with things, you clean up messes. And I know that some people are like, well, we should prevent messes first. And I think that's sort of like a underlying our discussion is that sort of like, which sort of mentality do you fall under? And your team's probably going to lean one way or the other. I think some teams are not good at trusting first, and some teams trust way too much. And I mean, there are people that trust way more than me, and I'm not okay with that. So,
yeah, I think a lot of that has to do with the maturity of the team too. Mm-hmm. If the team is less mature, meaning that they have a lower total combined years of knowledge in this particular framework, then they will be more likely to bring in gems a lot more freely because it solves a problem that they don't have to solve. But I think as the team matures, you'll find that they are a lot more skeptic about, let's just bring in this gem because it solves the problem. So I think it all of this advice, it's good advice, but also has to be taken, shaped, and molded to fit what your team where your team is currently at and what your team's goals are.
I mean, this is what our job is, right? Like navigating the trade-offs.
Yeah.
And I think you actually bring up a good point that's like really hard to like express, which is it's also probably one that like we can't particularly solve, which is that like younger teams. So, and by that, I don't necessarily mean age. I just mean like juniors and like how much development experience have you had, right? Kind of thing. And I think it's important also that you bring up like it kind of is like sort of the combined experience of your team that matters the most, right? But if you have a team full of juniors, they're one, not likely listening to the show in general, I feel like. Not because juniors don't listen to the show. I find that my experience has been that juniors seem to not be doing as much listening or whatever, as I feel like seniors have, or mid-levels and seniors are like, oh, I should probably be listening. I take that back. People are just all over the place. But I feel like, whatever, juniors, as a typical rule, are more likely to not know what they don't know. That's the most important point.
So back on the idea of red tape, I had to deal with this real dumb situation a long time ago. And essentially, I was not allowed to ship any code until I had secured down our authentication solution. We were using device, and the entire application was being served over HTTP, over SSL, and HSTS was enabled. So we had a layer of encryption for any traffic that was going over the web. However, we got dinged because when the person enters in their username and their password on the website, we are not encrypting the password on the client side before shipping it to the server. SSL didn't matter. They wanted a second layer of encryption. And so I implemented it. And it wasn't too hard. I used the library JS Encrypt. However, did that really even provide any actual security? So the only thing that this would have prevented was someone getting your password in the event of a man-in-the-middle attack. But with a modern browser, you're already going to know that you are being a victim of a man-in-the-middle attack. And that's essentially where someone has taken over your, not website, but really there is some kind of intermediary that should not be there, and they can listen in on all of your traffic. Either they're providing you their own SSL certificate or something so that they can decrypt the parameters that you're sending over, but your browser is going to bark at you saying that this is not a legitimate SSL cert anyway. So, I mean, we were solving a problem that really did not exist. And this came up from the higher ups in the organization saying that this is a deal breaker. You have to implement this functionality. It turns out what they really meant, because they didn't understand the domain or the issue, is that we had to have SSL on the whole website, that everything had to be encrypted, not the typing in the password, then posting it to the server had to be encrypted. They meant the overall communication. So sometimes I think red tape is introduced because higher ups or other people just don't understand what they're talking about or what they're being told. And I have no solution for that. I'm sorry. I wish I did.
So I'm here with JD from Raygun. JD, why did you start Raygun?
You know, I started Raygun. It was actually our 11th product that we built. So, you know, if you're a fellow software engineer thinking you want to build something and build a business, this was the 11th try, right? And we built it because way back when I was writing more code for customers, I used to instrument my code to send an email to myself when something went wrong. And it would let me kind of get in front of the issue before the customer complained. And so we built a whole product called Raygun for crash reporting initially. It expanded out into other areas, but it was really just building a full solution to what I'd been doing years earlier to try and build better software.
I love that. Just scratching your own itch. It makes a ton of sense. And I do that too with some of the stuff that I'm doing, either with podcasting or programming.
Yeah, absolutely. The most awkward thing was when we actually instrumented some of those prior 11 products, and that's when we realized that about 1% of users will ever actually report an issue. And you go, oh, we might have been a lot more successful earlier if we'd known that. So that's kind of the whole value prop of Raygun.
Yep, absolutely. And it makes sense just to put it in there. So folks, if you're looking to try something like this that'll tell you what your problems are, go check out raygun.com and get a free trial.
I really wanted to go back to the original thing that we were talking about, which is like, why do we have code review? Why do we have CI? Because I was actually thinking at the very beginning, I was like, you know, one of the things that's really important to me, and Chuck, you brought, I think it was Dave that you mentioned this, which is like, hey, if I'm in code review and somebody doesn't have the right spacing or something, right? Like, what should I do about that? And I was at RailsConf a while ago. I don't remember which one it was. And I'm pretty sure that it was Derek Pryor. And the reason why I think it was Derek Pryor is because then I started listening to the Bike Shed and I was like, oh, it's that guy. But I think he was giving a talk on like why you should use like basically a bot during code review. And the thing that he said like was whoever it was, but it was a male. I can confirm that. I mean, I don't know if we weren't doing pronouns at the time, but whatever. They said that I take away work that bots can do really easily, right? And potentially cause personal problems between you and somebody else. Take away that work and give it to the bot. Then it's no longer a personal issue ever again. And it's a lot easier for the bot to do anyway. Just give it to the bot, have CI run it and test it for you. And then you can make code review all about like, and I think there were like two things, which is like passing knowledge between you and the person that you're code reviewing for and basically discussing architecture issues. And that to this day has been like very, very important to me. That made sense to me. And we hadn't talked about the knowledge passing aspect either, because I think that code reviews are, there's two pieces to it. So one, if I write some code that I am now getting added to our code base, I want there to be other people on the team who vaguely know what I wrote about so that other people on the team feel confident in changing that stuff too. And then number two, I also want to be able to get consensus on some of the design choices that I made, because often what we're tasked with is, hey, we've got to deliver this feature, figure out how to get it done. So then you figure out how to get it done. And you maybe discussed with your teammates, you had a plan. You were like, oh, I think we're going to do it this way. But then you get in the weeds. It doesn't work out how you wanted it. And you figured out how to get it done. You bring it back to the team. You say, this is what I think we should try. And then somebody during code review says, well, you know, I see this problem with your architecture. You know, so now you're recreating the consensus that you lost because your battle plan didn't pan out the way that you expected it to.
I have to agree with all of that. I think if you have code reviews, that should be one of the primary goals of it. And from my experience, code reviews have been the complete opposite of that. Just in real world teams where it was more of a cascaded down requirement from the organization, you have to do code reviews. They don't specify what are we trying to get out of the code review. Just a code review must be done. And that's what it was. It was just simply ticking the box that, yes, technically a code review was done. I visibly and I optically saw the code that was getting merged in. And that's not what a code review is. And I think this is setting expectations of what is our purpose of this. You know, I'm not asking, you know, how to make a watch when I ask someone to tell me the time. But when I am a watchmaker trying to learn how to make a watch, I do need to know how to make it, if that makes any sense. And so I think that is one primary goal of the code review, is to make sure that we have shared the domain knowledge across the whole team. But also, I think that there can be another added benefit, because if you are doing a code review, there's a good chance that you are on a team of more than just yourself. And if you're on a team with more than just yourself, you probably care about your coworkers. And if you care about your coworkers, do you really want them to be banging their head against a keyboard as they are reviewing your code? Or do you want to try to make your code a lot more readable? So it kind of goes back to the whole like Perl joke, that Perl's meant to be written, not read. And do we really want to make our code reviews a painful process? Or do we want to make it something where it's a lot more enjoyable? So one of the things that I've been trying to do lately over the past few years is to write simple code. I don't try to do any kind of crazy metaprogramming or anything like that where you have to reread 10 times the bit of code I wrote in order to understand what the heck's actually going to happen. But I make it in a much more readable format. And I'm not introducing a plain old Ruby object that has 30 different entry points that could be called from any which way, but just a single entry point. The poro is small. It does one thing. It does that one thing very simply, easy to read, and that kind of stuff. So I think that knowing that your code will be reviewed could help motivate you to maybe adopt a different style of development, making it easier to read or just a different approach to your organization of your thought logic or the code itself.
To jump on the bandwagon here with you, Dave, on code review do's and don'ts, if you will, I've also started being much more lenient on code reviews in that, going back to the bike shedding where a bot goes and comments on styling, if that's something that you want to introduce or not, it's kind of up to you. I definitely don't adhere to that, but it costs money to go through code review, right? Like, somebody's paying all the people looking at that code in code review to approve it or make comments. If comments are made, that costs money to make changes. And not to nickel and dime code reviews, but a lot of times it's just unnecessary to point out you would do it a different way or stylistic things. It's almost not worth the money to point it out, especially when you can comment in a different way. And what the approach I've taken is non-blocking versus blocking. And I've tried to leave less non-blocking comments and more blocking comments. So if somebody has a typo in their code, I'll point that out. Hey, you know, here's a typo. This isn't going to work as you might expect. Or sometimes, you know, logic can get complicated and there would be a condition that would never be satisfied. And that can be caught in a code review. That would be another blocking one. And you doing this over time, I've definitely left much less comments, right? Where, okay, if something that you would normally comment on as being might work out well for refactoring later, it's worth leaving the comment in there and saying non-blocking, but we should think about refactoring this in a different way. It looks like we're leading this way. Leaving those more non-blocking comments as kind of just, you know, informational purposes for historical reasons, saying, hey, let's revisit this later, and you have some project management software story to look into it, you can reference the conversation and keep the conversation there without actually blocking any progress on, you know, the code that's being changed.
I had a funny thought. What if we just got rid of code reviews entirely? And you know, hang with me here, because, you know, I'm saying get rid of them, but we're actually not getting rid of them. So instead of...
I think some people got stressed out.
How many of you all have a multiple person team that you work on and you have daily stand-ups? And during these daily stand-ups, you just talk about what you did the previous day, what you're going to do today. And there's actually been fruit coming out of every single one of these stand-ups to where you can say like, wow, okay, yeah, so you're going in this direction and we're doing this. Oh, wow. Okay. That's going to completely shift the paradigm in how I'm approaching this problem. I maybe have seen that happen once or twice over a year's worth of stand-ups. Mostly it's been, yeah, I worked on this yesterday. I did this, not blocked. So, you know, that's it. And you end up with a team of 4 people, 6 people doing these daily stand-ups, taking up 15, 20 minutes of your time with no fruit being produced. You just gain the knowledge, okay, no one's blocked. But what if during a stand-up, you actually kind of go through and say, hey, here's the actual code that I wrote yesterday. I went through, you know, here's the problem that I'm trying to solve. Here is my implementation that's a work in progress of what I've done. stepping through the code because the owner of that code or the person who wrote it is going to have a bit more knowledge in the immediate of what that code is actually doing or trying to do. And you can give much more immediate feedback at that point in time rather than waiting until the point where they feel like it is completed, only to then say, hey, we got to revisit this. I know that this technically works, but that's not the direction we were hoping for.
Sounds like to me somebody's following the Agile Manifesto right there. Changing your process when your process isn't functioning as you expect it to. Yeah. I don't know that I would do that at every company, but I like that we're discussing it. For me, I think that code review doesn't work at companies where code review isn't valued. I think it has no purpose. In the same way, I think that when standups are not valued, they just become, I did this, yes, I worked on ticket number whatever, and I'm over here, and you say 4072, and I'm like, I have no idea what 4072 is. I'm working on 3996. And I'm just, but because you, that's what everybody does every day, like, no information gets passed. I waste 15 minutes of my day. And the only thing that really happened is that somebody on your team is writing down whether somebody's working on tickets or something. And I'm like, well, can't you just look in Jira or whatever thing that we're doing and see who's working on the ticket anyway? Like, why are we doing this like every day if we're not really communicating anything to each other? I know there are teams that do use stand-up to communicate stuff. But for those teams that aren't, is it really functioning to do anything? And I think to your point, Dave, I think I agree with you. If you're on a team where you're questioning whether your code review process or your stand-up is giving you the value or any value or, you know, whatever you think it's value it's supposed to be giving you, if it's not accomplishing the thing that you think it's supposed to be accomplishing, maybe you should look at that and change something. Whether that's to combine the two into some really awesome 30-minute, like, hey, let's talk to each other about code time, which actually could be kind of cool in some places, or to do something else, I think it's important to change your process. Something. Yeah.
One thing we did in the past at a previous employer was limit our stand-ups only if you had blockers. So if there's a blocker, let's pull the team together. Let's identify what the blocker is and let's discuss it to see how we can remove that block in order to proceed on with our sprint work. And if there were no blockers, then there was no meeting. But we also had a weekly meeting that was about the combined amount of time that you would spend during stand-up, just demoing what you have worked on. Whether it was on the web front end or if it's something that's just more code, just displaying the code. And we got a lot better feedback from those sessions than I ever have gotten from a stand-up or a code review. So in the most part, if you are just meeting at the same time every single day for a stand-up, there's no value coming from it, then it's just an attendance check. You don't need a stand-up taking away everyone's time for 15 minutes because it's not 15 minutes, especially if your stand-up is happening midday. That's 15 minutes before the stand-up that I get the notification that, oh, I have a stand-up soon. Okay, I need to unwind from what I'm currently working on right now so I don't miss getting on stand-up. And then once the 15 minutes of stand-up is over and people just chit-chatting and not providing actual value to my daily work, then like, okay, well, oh, I wonder what my, you know, if I've received any emails or I wonder what's going on with Twitter, there's another 15 minutes. So that 5-10 minute stand-up time is actually costing the company 45 minutes.
Ramp up time. Plus yeah. Everybody pings you over the course of the next hour because you said something or they said something in stand-up and just, that's what happens.
I've rarely seen stand-up not be a waste of time. And that's just personally.
I really liked that idea, Dave. I feel like
I do too. We
should talk about that.
So
sometime.
Kind of going back to the idea of red tape, this is more of a design pattern than it is so much of a red tape piece. But if you've read any article from the past 15 years, not any article, but a lot of articles, you will see the whole dry principle. Like, don't repeat yourself. And as a general premise, I agree with the principle at its core, but I think in practice, it is very harmful. Because if you're having to obfuscate your code, that makes it less readable for the sake of being dry, then you are going to be spending a lot more time during code review trying to figure out what the heck this is doing. And if you're drying up things so you're not repeating yourself in other areas outside of the code, then you are introducing some real headaches. And this is kind of getting into the deployment process. If you are working on a microservices level application and you say, okay, one thing is going to be in common with all of our microservices, we are going to have all of these deployed to some kind of Docker environment, Docker Swarm, ECS, whatever the case. But we don't want to have to rewrite this Docker file 100 different times for 100 different services. So we are going to create this real fancy Docker file that can be interchanged and used for every single one of our microservices. Well, that's a great idea because you now have one single place where basically the entire application level of your infrastructure is all contained. Until you had to change something. And then when you change something, you're not worrying about just that one microservice that you're having to change and getting it working there. Now you are worried about the entire stack of 100 microservices. And is this going to work? Is it going to break something? Is one of them not dependent on a certain image that you were expecting when you were making this change? So I think keeping things, even if it means repeating yourself as simple as possible, is going to be so much more important than not repeating yourself.
I do think that like many of the principles that we have, right? Whether you go for dry or wet on around a particular thing is a judgment call that you have to make. Because I've had to make the same choice as well, right? Where I realized that two particular areas in the code or something, right, were just disparate enough that like we weren't going to be like looking at them at the same time. And so if I'm trying to make it too dry, right, and refactor something that both have in common, then I end up in a scenario where, just like you said, now I have to consider every case of the one place and every case of the other place whenever I'm doing anything in that refactored area, right? So yeah, I would absolutely agree with you that they're 100% of the time. I'm sorry. Let me say this way better. I absolutely agree with you that there are cases when we should make our code wet instead of dry. I think that you can go too extreme that way too, but I have been on plenty of code bases where they refactored it way too much and increased the coupling by doing that.
Wasn't it Avdi that said no code is the best code?
I don't know if he was the first person, but I think that I vaguely recall them being said together, the name and the statement.
It reminds me of one of Aaron Patterson's keynotes that he did at RailsConf, where he just started stripping away more and more code to say, hey, look, it's still running.
It's true. KISS principle has been around for a long time. It's a thing. And it doesn't just apply to software engineering.
Yep, I agree. Yeah, whenever I'm
Which
doing...
makes it more likely to be true.
Yeah. Right. Whenever I'm doing any kind of woodworking, the whole KISS principle is out the window. I over-engineer whatever I'm building, and I'm using probably 100 nails per square foot more than I should be. But the thing's solid, built like a tank. But tearing it apart and trying to change it after the fact, it's like impossible.
I mean, there are different goals, to be fair, and when you're building stuff out of wood, or when you're building stuff in general that are physical objects versus when you're building in software. We know that we're going to change it later, whereas physical objects, we're often hoping that we will never change it.
Yeah. So, and you know, sometimes it's just fun. Like, I'm pretty sure Chuck will know this. Do you know what a powder nailer is?
A powder nailer?
Yeah. It's like a nail gun, but you literally load a blank black powder cartridge behind a nail, and then you tap the end of the nailer and it'll shoot. So it's really like a gun, but it shoots nails into concrete. So it's how you put studs onto a concrete foundation.
Oh, okay.
Well, when I was building my shed, I needed just like, you know, maybe 30 nails. I ended up putting like 100 nails into the foundation because it was so much fun just shooting those nails in.
So is your concrete a lot weaker because of that?
I don't know. I mean, it's a shed, so who cares?
Yeah, fair enough. It's fine.
Yeah. I've only anchored things into concrete with a hammer drill and concrete anchors. So
that's how I've done it.
Yep.
Hammer drills are amazing. Just throwing that out there.
They are. But look into powder nailers. They are amazing. They're so much fun.
Gem install hammer drill. All right.
Were there any points that we like sort of skated past that we should like revisit and actually say, or do we feel like we actually like hit all the things?
One thing that you brought up that I kind of wanted to talk about for a minute is you talked about, well, hey, we have a QA team and they kind of have this other focus or this other job, right? And sometimes you'll have a DevOps team that does a lot of this stuff too, right? Where it's setting up CI and making sure that everything deploys when it's supposed to and all that stuff. And so my question is with some of this red tape, for lack of a better term, you have other teams that handle part of the process. So if they're handling that part of the process, I was never completely comfortable entirely handing it off. I was always more comfortable kind of doing what I could to make sure that the quality was there and then letting them do their thorough piece of it as well. And I'm just curious, do you look for teams or places where teams can take on parts of this responsibility, or do you still hold on to some of it even if they're there?
I think that's a cultural thing, right? So I like division of responsibility because I like, am I capable of wearing more than one hat? Yes. And I've had to do it most of my career in various places, right? But I do like being able to focus on a thing. And you sit next to me, well, not necessarily physically next to me, but virtually next to me, whatever. You focus on your thing. And because we're doing these separate things together, we're like better for it, right? I like working like that. And so I guess what I really want to say is like, I found myself on teams where that was the intention, right? We have a QA team because we want the QA team to like look for stuff. And I think that some people are like, well, we can add extra people into the process or extra things into the process. And I feel like that's really just saying that you just don't trust the process, right? And so if you don't trust the process for some reason, I feel like you should address that issue, right? If you're like, well, our QA team isn't finding enough bugs, so we're going to put developers onto it, I feel like you should be addressing like why your QA team isn't finding bugs. Now, maybe that's because you don't have enough people on your QA team. Maybe it's because your process isn't good enough within your QA department. Maybe it's because your developers literally are not testing the thing before they commit, like you pointed out, right? Like, clearly, if there's a trust issue, right, it's because something's going on and you should address the issue, I guess is how I feel like it. And I feel like when you hear people say, oh, well, we're just going to add bodies, right? When people are saying like, hey, well, I'll test it and I'll add myself to the process, you're just throwing bodies at the problem. I feel like there's often much better solutions than to just add more, you know, just keep adding more eyes. Sometimes there's not. And I think that's okay. Like if your team says, hey, look, this is the resources that we have right now. We just need our developers to like, you know, pick up a portion of it. If that's a choice you make, that's fine. I think. I just think that having that attitude everywhere in every team or whatever, I think it's not going to be a fit for a lot of teams. And I've definitely been to places where somebody was just like, well, I just pull down everything in code review because I think that I should just be testing this stuff.
Mm-hmm.
That's just how they felt they should be. And they weren't adding value because that wasn't their job. And the QA team was very effective, things like that, right? It's not wrong. It's just, I think that you should know why you're doing something. Because otherwise, because if you're doing that every time, there's a few things that happen. One, you're setting an expectation for other people to mm-hmm. do that, right? And maybe the other people that are on your team don't think that that's the right way to do things or whatever. They're not in agreement with you, right?
Right.
So now you have conflict there. that you now have to address. Yeah, really, at the end of the day, it's just important to know why you're doing stuff and to have good reasons for it and decide that's what you want to do. I think that Dave brought up the point that at his place of work, they created a process a long time ago and they kind of like forgot why they're doing it. And so now they just have process, people check a box, and they're not accomplishing the whole purpose of the process anymore.
Yep.
And that's frustrating too.
That is red tape.
Yeah.
When a process produce value, and it is there merely to tick a box.
So, yeah, for me, it's more that, like, I'm not saying, oh, I'm going to do DevOps and they're going to do DevOps. It's more along the lines of, I'm going to cover everything up to the line that they're supposed to, where they're supposed to take over. And I'm going to do it in such a way to where I know that the gap is covered. Like, if there's any gap, it's covered, right? And then they can take it from there. And
I think, yeah, DevOps is a little different. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, or QA for that matter. I mean, there are some things that I'm just going to be better equipped to look at than they are.
I mean, there's definitely a section of tests that we own, right? So yeah. As Rails developers, right, we're used to like sort of this culture of testing, right? One of the things, okay, so I will make a slight complaint about a place that I've worked at, you know, somewhat recently or whatever. There's tons of tests. I would love to just delete like a huge group of tests. But we have this thing and I have not won the discussion yet. I still believe that I will be able to in the future to remove the whole like we need to reach this particular code coverage threshold. So we have a whole bunch of tests that are providing zero value because they test nothing. Like in some cases, they test the Rails framework. And I'm a big believer that like there's zero reason to test that the Rails framework works. Like that's why the Rails framework has its own tests. Like,
right.
Don't double test that. Especially when you are writing those tests. And because you write those tests, you reach your code coverage threshold. And so you stop writing tests on the other things. So people are just checking a box right there, right? So I definitely would love to delete a huge chunk of tests in our code suite and be like, hey guys, we don't actually have real tests here. We're just testing junk and we should reevaluate what's going on here. Yeah, you should own your test suite as developers, right? That's why you have it. Unless your QA team writes your tests or something.
Yeah,
I've never been on a team that done that.
Depends on how many clients you have, because then that's how many QA people you have. Sorry, it's a very dry joke.
Anyway,
it did take me a second, but it was good.
So I think, you know, this also kind of speaks to when we're talking about process is silos. And essentially a silo is when only one person on the team is able to do something. I think from a business perspective, that's very dangerous on a number of accounts. If someone is out for an extended period of time and they've been the only person responsible for deploying your application, they are the only ones who know the process, then that is a serious gap in knowledge or a silo that needs to be broken up. I think that we should not. And there's a lot of reasons why this happens. Worst case scenario, it is because someone feels like they need that importance to have that kind of power within the team. And those are just horrible situations. But other times, that's just how the cards have landed. And no one has spoken up to say, hey, this person has been doing the deployments. They're the only one who does the deployments. And because of that, if this person's out, deployments, you know, come to a halt, especially if your CI/CD platform isn't automatically deploying, which I think in smaller companies, you can get away with that. If you're a very large company, you can get away with that. But in a everywhere in between, which I think most applications sit, where companies are a bit more traditional, where they have deployment windows, they deploy on this time, on this date, or whatever, just so all those expectations can be cascaded up to the rest of the organization, you run a risk of missing those deadlines or windows because that person is out for whatever reason. And so if your process for deploying is complicated, if every one of your team members on the team or your DevOps team, you know, doesn't have to be the development team, has trouble following that process or it does not work consistently, then there is a real gap within your process. And that does need to be addressed.
If your deployment process does not work consistently, I am a very big believer that you should spend some time and energy to address that. I feel like that's such a huge risk in my book, but I care about that particular thing. It's also the reason why I've just been very involved in DevOpsy stuff.
All right. Well, I've got a hard stop in like 10 minutes, so I'm going to push us toward picks.
All right.
Choose your picks.
Hi, this is Charles Max Wood from Top End Devs. And lately I've been coaching some people on starting some podcasts and in some cases, just taking their career to the next level. You know, whether you're beginner going to intermediate, intermediate going to advanced, whether you're trying to get noticed in the community or go freelance, I've been helping these folks figure out how to get in front of people, how to build relationships and how to build their careers and max out and just go to the next level. So if you're interested in talking to me and having me help you go to the next level, go to topendevs.com/coaching. I will give you a 1 hour free session where we can figure out what you're trying to do, where you're trying to go, and figure out what the next steps are. And then from there, we can figure out how to get you to the place you want to go. So once again, that's topendevs.com/coaching.
All right, Valentino, why don't we have you start with picks?
Sure. So I got a few picks here, two tool related to what we're talking about and two kind of blog post talk related. The first one is a tool I'm a core contributor to called Git Reflow, and it lets you create automated workflows in using Ruby from a Git specific localized standpoint. I used it to create one for Doximity. It's been working awesome. Just automates a lot of stuff, steps along the way, removes some of that red tape. Another one is Danger Systems. It's another automated code tool for doing common code review chores, and it's more of like a GitHub adapter. It's like one of those bots, like we talked about earlier, to automate some of the linting and various things. You could set up different rules for it. Another one is kind of like a really interesting idea from Kent Beck on kind of doing, what is it called, TCR, which basically comes down to making changes automatically and deploying them immediately once the tests pass. So if the tests pass, then the code gets committed and deployed. Otherwise, it gets reverted automatically and the code just kind of disappears. So there's an article he wrote on that I'll share that is pretty great. And the last one is a talk that Avdi Grimm gave Southeast Ruby called No Code. That's really great. Talks about how a lot of code you just better off not writing. And that's it.
Awesome. John, what are your picks?
All right. So I have one that's sort of related because I was just thinking about this at the very end here. I think as we were discussing, like one of the things that came up in my head is like, if you don't have a process and you're like trying to find and you're trying to build a process, I think there's like tons of tools out there. If your deployment solution really sucks, I'm a big fan of the Docker world. I think it's really great. I think you should check it out. And if you're having trouble getting those Docker Compose things into production, I'm totally going to toot my own horn. You should try out Shiplane. Dave, you should check it out because you said you hadn't checked it out yet. So Shiplane for deploying getting your stuff to production, DevOps related. And then second thing that I'm recommending here is now that Scotch doesn't cost like your entire month's wages to buy a single bottle, I'm occasionally purchasing some stuff again. It was never quite that expensive, but it did like double and triple in price during like COVID. So the one that I am pulling up here is I got another bottle of Glen Scotia 15 year, and it's amazing. And you should, if you're ever thinking about, if you liked whiskey like beforehand and you're like, the whiskey distilleries are not really, they don't seem to be open, or like a bunch of them closed during COVID, and you're just like not knowing what to do in your journey, try out Scotch. There's a bunch of things out there. And highly recommend the Glen Scotia 15-year. It's very different from a lot of other things. It's awesome. Also, because it's a 15-year, it's not too harsh. So that's my picks.
All right, Dave, what are your picks?
So my first pick is Plausible, which is a GDPR-friendly analytics app. It is self-hosted, or you can host it with them. It's really awesome. I like it. It does what I need without being invasive on the customer's privacies. So that's the first pick. And the second pick, I don't even know how to title it. So I'm going to just say parenting. And the backstory here is I lost my cool the other day, which is really embarrassing and doesn't happen often at all. But I was trying to take a video of my one-year-old where she was, she had a broom and a dustpan and she was sweeping, she was standing, and it was really, really cute. So I told my kids, like, hey, kids, I want to get this video shot of their Hope doing her sweeping. And of course, they saw that as a challenge to be as loud as possible and to fight and to hit, kick, bite, and spill things and just create utter chaos. So I stopped recording, told them, like, hey, stop it. And, you know, I just really want to get this video clip. And of course, they saw that as a challenge to escalate it to even further throw things, break things and stuff. So I finally just slammed my hand on the table and say, kids, I just want to get this video clip, please. And little did I know, my phone was in my hand and it completely shattered the front and back. So immediately the kids were like, hey, they stop. You know, all the fighting, all the turmoil and chaos stops. And they said, Dad, why did you break your phone? And my son, who internalizes this kind of stuff, he takes like blame or he feels like it's his fault. I was very clear to them, like, kids, look, my phone breaking has nothing to do with you. That is not your fault. That is not your responsibility. That is my fault. That's my responsibility because I chose to do that. It's not something that you guys need to feel bad about. Because I made that choice, it was a bad choice, I have to pay the consequences. You know, phones cost a lot of money. I have to pay a lot of money. But in no part are you guys at fault for this at all. So I think just taking ownership in our actions and reactions to things to not rebuild the same kind of generation that we grew up in, if, you know, that's applicable to you. So
yeah, that's great advice just for anybody, I think. It's just owning your mistakes. And yeah, it's super powerful when you do it with your kids. I'm going to jump in with a few picks. The first pick that I have, I've been doing board games. This one is kind of a board game and mostly a dice game. It's called Dice Forge. We played it with my brother and sister-in-law. They had it and we went out of town this weekend and we were playing it. And what you do is you take the dice and you roll it, you get gold, you can buy cards. You also get some other kinds of tokens. But anyway, that just allows you to get more cards. The cards allow you to basically swap out the faces of your dice. And so if you can think of kind of the little flat dice or Lego pieces, then yeah, you just snap them off and snap the other ones on. And then you can roll the dice for better stuff. And, you know, you play for victory points and you win. Anyway, it was super fun. Really enjoyed that one. And so I'm going to pick it. I'm not sure I have much else to pick beyond that. So I'm just going to... Oh, one other... I guess I do have another one that's kind of relevant to what we talked about here. So I talked to a company that was interested in sponsoring some of the shows. I don't know if they're going to wind up sponsoring this one or a different one or at all. But they had a really interesting project. It's called Mergify. And it basically automates a lot of the pull request management and stuff like that on GitHub. And so effectively, you can set up rules, right? So if it has one review or two reviews, if it passes CI, if it's tagged with a certain tag, then when all those conditions are met, it'll merge it, right? And then you can set up queues for it to, so it'll merge this branch and then it'll merge the main branch to another branch and then make sure that it passes CI before it merges it in. So if you have a couple of things that you're just kind of waiting on to all go into the main branch, it'll manage all of that in a queue. Anyway, it had some really cool features. So you can go check it out. It's Mergify, and I'll put a link to that in the show notes. All right. Well, let's go ahead and wrap it up here. Till next time, folks, Max out.
Bandwidth for this segment is provided by CacheFly, the world's fastest CDN. Deliver your content fast with CacheFly. Visit CacheFly.com to learn more.